interested at all as that which we have been considering, please turn to page 123 of the notes. Page 123. Not so blessed, but perhaps in its own way just as important. As we noticed earlier, the statement of the confession tells us three things about the condition of the wicked in the intermediate state: its location, hell; its circumstances, torment and darkness; and its expectation, looking for the judgment of the great day. To thoroughly appreciate the biblical basis for these assertions, we must examine two matters: the basic biblical words relating to the condition of the wicked, and the basic biblical text discussing the condition of the wicked. First of all, the basic biblical words relating to the condition of the wicked. And here we have to deal, first of all, with false views of Sheol, or Sheol. No treatment of the intermediate state of the wicked would be complete which did not address itself to the meaning of the term Sheol in the Old Testament and its New Testament equivalent, Hades. Uncertainty, confusion, and error surround especially the meaning of Sheol in the Old Testament. Cults like the Jehovah's Witnesses assert that it means oblivion or non-existence, but the sufficient rebuttal of this is the nonsense it makes of a passage like Deuteronomy 32:22, which says, "The wrath of God shall burn to the lowest Sheol," and certainly does not mean that it burns to the lowest non-existence. Modernism, and some evangelicals influenced by modernism, think that it refers to a shadowy netherworld or underworld. According to this view, the Jewish view of the afterlife was profoundly influenced by the nations around them. The popular idea of the day was that all men, both good and bad, went to a gloomy netherworld. This view is based on those texts in the Old Testament which teach or imply that all men go to the same place, Sheol, when they die. Now, turn please to Ecclesiastes. I'm going to ask Larry Springer if you'd also get your finger into Genesis 37:35, and Bob into 2 Samuel 12:23. But I want you to look at the book of Ecclesiastes to see the apparent support for this idea that all go to the same shadowy netherworld, all go to the same place in the Old Testament. Ecclesiastes is the key book here, but there are other statements that are also relevant. Ecclesiastes 2:14, "The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and then I know that one fate befalls them both." 3:19, "For the fate of the sons of men, the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust." 6:6, "Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place." 7:2, "It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man." 9:2 and 3, "It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean and the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. This as an is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead." In 9:10, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom." And here that one place where all are going is identified: in Sheol, where you are going. And compare with this Genesis 37:35.
"And all of his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, 'For I shall go down into the grave, to my son in mourning, thus his father wept for
I will go down, and the Hebrew says there, Sheol, to Sheol in mourning for my son. Here's righteous Jacob asserting that he's going to go down into Sheol. And I believe this is the meaning, I guess I just stick this in as a kicker to make you curious, but I think believe that this is the meaning of 2 Samuel 12:23, where David says,
but now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me.
I believe the meaning of that text in its Old Testament context is that the baby went to Sheol, and David is going to Sheol. The baby is not coming back from Sheol, but David is going there as well. At any rate, whether you agree with that or not, these texts certainly do teach that all men go to Sheol when they die. Yet, as we shall see, the assumption that Sheol is used to refer to only one thing, this netherworld that encompasses all the dead, is very unlikely. This view fails to do justice to those texts which clearly teach that there is a distinction between the righteous and the wicked when they die. So if the Old Testament teaches that in one sense all go to the same place, it also teaches that the righteous and the wicked don't go to the same place. Look at Proverbs 14:32. Proverbs 14 and verse 32. The wicked is thrust down by his wrongdoing. And that language suggests Sheol. Thrust down to Sheol by his wrongdoing. But the righteous has a refuge when he dies. There is clear evidence in the Old Testament that the righteous experience a blessed afterlife, while the wicked one of punishment. And so the idea that Sheol means a shadowy netherworld is not consistent with that particular emphasis of the Old Testament, although it seems consistent with the idea that all go to the same place, to Sheol. Intertestamental Judaism viewed, and many modern dispensationalists view, Sheol as containing at least two different compartments. One for the righteous and one for the unrighteous. Weiss gives this account of the view just mentioned. The main development in this period comes from the fact that Sheol is now divided into two compartments, one for the good, called paradise, the other for the evil, called Gehenna. This theory, I think you can see how this theory would develop. Here you have the basic data of the Old Testament. All go to Sheol. And yet, on the other hand, you have the assertion of the Old Testament that the wicked and righteous have different destinies when they die. Now, if you were an intertestamental rabbi, and a little bit naive, how would you put those two Old Testament assertions together? Well, what they did was say, oh, the answer is obvious. What you have to understand is that there are two compartments in Sheol. There's the place where the righteous go. That's called paradise, or Abraham's bosom. And there's the place where the wicked go. That's called Gehenna. So Sheol has two compartments, one for the righteous and one for the wicked. And that way, they fitted all the Old Testament data together. Very logical. And this has seemed a logical theory to many since the time of intertestamental Judaism. Some early church fathers and modern dispensationalists adopted this theory and elaborated it from a Christian point of view. And this theory may be diagrammed as I have there or as it is in the book. Now the objections, however, to this theory are many. They are first that the Old Testament contradicts this teaching by asserting that believers even then went to heaven and not to Sheol. Heaven is the opposite of Sheol. Sheol is that which is below, as we're going to see. Heaven is that which is above. And that assertion that believers, even in the Old Testament, went to heaven is, of course, contained in the text we looked at previously about Enoch being taken by God. 2 Kings 2:1-11, which asserts that Elijah went up to heaven. The assertion of the psalmist that he expected to go to the house of the Lord, a synonym for heaven. In Psalm 73, verses 23 and 24, which speaks of it as glory or honor. And certainly we're not to think of the house of the Lord as being built in a part of Sheol. Now, second, as we have seen previously, paradise in the New Testament is identified with heaven. In this theory, paradise is identified with something other than heaven as a compartment, so to speak, in Sheol. The New Testament identifies it as heaven. I want you to look at a couple of passages here that we haven't looked at in detail before. First of all, I want you to look at 2 Corinthians 12. Because here you have Paul's language which identifies heaven and paradise. 2 know a man in Christ, verse 2, who 14 years ago, whether in the body, I do not know, or out of the body, I do not know, God knows, such a man was caught up to the third heaven. And then he goes on to recapitulate, and I know how such a man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, God knows, was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words which a man is not permitted to speak. Now, this language is parallel, and I believe it identifies paradise with the third heaven. And what is also inconsistent with the idea that paradise is in Sheol below is that Paul says he was caught up into paradise, which tends to identify it with heaven as well, for some reasons that we'll come on to see. Look at Revelation 2:7, where plainly paradise is identified here, probably first of all with heaven, which anticipates the eternal state. Revelation 2 and verse 7, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Here the tree of life is said to be in the paradise of God. It's also in the new heaven and the new earth, and spiritually speaking, whatever the symbolic language means here, it is in heaven now. And then, of course, you have the language of our Lord, which promises the thief on the cross, that very day he would be with Christ in paradise. And though some have thought that Christ descended into hell in some literal sense and might find that statement compatible with that theory, the fact is the Bible teaches that Christ had asked the Father to receive his Spirit and that he went to heaven when he died, and that the paradise is therefore identified as heaven in Luke 23:43. The third thing wrong with this theory is that it's not consistent with Luke 16:22. Luke 16:22 is often appealed to as grounding this theory in the New Testament. The problem is the exact language of the text contradicts the theory. Look at it. Luke 16:22 says, "Now the poor man died and was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom, and the rich man also died and was buried. In Hades he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far away and Lazarus in his bosom." The point that we have to make from this text is that the rich man is not in Gehenna. He is in Hades. And Hades is the Greek equivalent to Sheol, the New Testament, a Greek translation of Sheol throughout the Old Testament and in the New Testament parallels. Paradise, or Abraham's bosom, is not contrasted with Gehenna, but with Hades. So Hades equals Sheol is not in the same place with Abraham's bosom. Rather, you have Abraham's bosom, equivalent to paradise, contrasted with Hades equal Sheol. So this language, though it sometimes appeals to justify the theory, actually contradicts it because of the equivalence of Hades and Sheol. But the best rebuttal to such theories is a proper understanding of the biblical meaning of Sheol, and we now turn to a consideration of this, to the proper understanding of Sheol. It's a crucial premise, first of all. This crucial premise is simply, that it's very plainly, that Sheol and Hades, its equivalent, do not always refer to the same thing when used in the Bible. Now, this premise, that they don't always refer to the same thing, is denied by each of the false interpretations. All these interpretations, that of the Jehovah's Witnesses, that of the modernists and neo-evangelicals, that of the dispensationalists, always have for their assumption that Sheol always means the same thing in the Bible. But that premise is false. That assumption is false. And we can see that it should be false, or the possibility that it is false, from the analogy of the biblical word death, a closely related word, which has several different meanings in the Bible. Death in the Bible may be physical death, spiritual death, and eternal death. And the assumption that death always refers to the same thing in the Bible is as wrong as the assumption that Sheol always means the same thing in the Bible. And yet that is the assumption of each of the false theories. Burkhoff asserts that a word study of the use of Sheol in the Old Testament will quickly prove that this word does not always have the same meaning. He notes that many Orthodox interpreters agree with him. But then I want to come on to a second thing, and that is to look at the general meaning of the word Sheol. The derivation of the word Sheol is uncertain. There are several different ways that Hebraists explain its etymology. This does not mean, however, that in its general meaning, the scriptures are unclear about what it generally designates. Though it has different references or meanings in the Bible, it does have a single general meaning from which these different references are derived. In fact, the first six passages where it's used in the Bible are sufficient to make this general meaning perfectly clear. That's conveniently enough, six men in the front row. So let's look at these texts. Genesis 37:35, Larry, 42:38, Bob, Marty, 44:29-31, Numbers 16:30, Mike, and 33 as well. Deuteronomy 32:22, Dave, and 1 Samuel 2:6, Scott. These are the first six occurrences of the word Sheol in the Bible. And I think the reading of them and a little bit of meditation on them will show that there is a general meaning, an overarching idea that characterizes each one of these texts, though the exact references may be different. Look at Genesis 37:35, first of all.
And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning, thus his father wept for
him." All right, notice the language, "I will go down to Sheol." 42:38.
But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave."
Notice the language, down to Sheol. 44:29-31.
"And if you take this also from me, and mischief befall him, he shall bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to thy servant, my father, and the lad be not with us, seeing that his life is bound up in the lad's life, it shall come to pass, when he seeth that the lad is not with us, that he will die. And thy servant shall bring down the gray hairs of the servant our father with sorrow to the grave."
Again, notice both in 29 and 31 the language, down to Sheol. Numbers 16, 30 and 33.
"But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is there, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst."
Notice the language again. Descend alive into Sheol, verse 33, down alive to Sheol. And then Deuteronomy 32:22.
"For a fire is kindled in my anger, and shall burn to the lowest hell or Sheol. It shall consume the earth with her increase, and set on fire the foundations of the mountain."
Notice the language. Lowest part of Sheol, the foundations of the mountains. And finally, 1 Samuel 2 and verse 6.
"The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up."
He brings down to to Sheol. Now, I'm prepared to assert, and I think it's an obvious assertion to make, that on the basis of these first six passages where the word is used in the Bible, Sheol, whatever more specific reference it may have in different texts, or more specific meaning it may take on, certainly designates, as to the general idea of the word, that which is below. It is the place below. And now let me come to give you a suggested analogy for this. This general meaning suggests a helpful analogy to clarify the meaning and usage of Sheol in the Bible. If Sheol is that which is below, what is the word which is its biblical opposite? Well, it is the Hebrew word Shemayim, translated heaven or heavens. Just as Sheol is that which is below, so also Shemayim is that which is above. Larry, get us Job 11:8. Bob, Psalm 139:8. Amos 9:2. Marty, notice the contrast in these texts between Sheol and Shemayim, instituted in these different places in the Old Testament. Job 11:8.
They are higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol. What can you know?
Notice the contrast. Psalm 139:8.
If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there.
Mm-hmm. And Amos 9 and verse 2. Diving to the depths of the minor prophets. Amos 9:2.
So they dig into hell, then shall my hand take them. So they climb up to heaven, that's why I bring them down.
I think it's very helpful to think of Sheol as the opposite of Shemayim. And this contrast is encouraged by these texts. The point of interest for us is that Shemayim in the Bible is also used to refer to different realities, has different references. Three heavens are distinguished in the Bible: the airy heavens, the starry heavens, and the heaven of God. And given the conceptual similarity of the word Shemayim with the word Sheol, this suggests that Sheol also may refer to diverse realities. The visible heavens are that which is above. Hence, they are associated with God and symbolize the place of his abode and of blessedness, of light, you see, and of blessedness. Sheol, that which is literally below, is thus associated with that which is the antithesis of God and blessedness and light, therefore darkness and misery and, of course, evil. It therefore symbolizes the place of woe and torment, which is devoid of the divine presence and blessing. Sometimes, therefore, it's used of the grave, that which is literally below. But in other instances of hell, because the grave is a symbol of divine judgment, and thus of hell. The following diagram illustrates the analogy between Shemayim and Sheol. In terms of the earth, you may look up and see the different heavens, and finally the heaven of God. In terms of the earth as well, you may look down and see the grave, and then below it, Sheol of fire. Now, there's some confirming evidence for this interpretation. The key evidence for this interpretation of Sheol is that this word is, in fact, used of hell, the place of punishment for the wicked after death. And there are a number of texts in the Old Testament where this meaning of Sheol as hell naturally commends itself. We've already seen Deuteronomy 32:22, God's wrath burns to the lowest part of Sheol. Naturally there, the idea of hell is suggested. Look at some other texts now. Where did I leave off? Mike, Job 21:13, Dave 24:19 of Job, 26:6, Scott, Psalm 9:17, Larry, Proverbs 5:5, and 9:18 as well. Bob, will give you two texts there. And Marty, Proverbs 15:24 and 23:14. Let's look at these texts and notice how in these texts, how natural the meaning of hell would be. Job 21:13.
They spend their days in prosperity, and suddenly they go down to Sheol.
All right. And since it's speaking, I believe, of the wicked in this context, it's natural to think of this as the punishment of the wicked. And then 24:19.
As drought and heat consume the snow waters, so should the grave or Sheol those who have sinned.
Notice, those who have sinned, not everybody. And therefore, again, the term hell, reference hell, is more appropriate or natural here. 26:6.
Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering.
Okay, and then Psalm 9:17 also suggests the meaning hell.
The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all the nations that forget God.
Again, since it's particularly the wicked who return to Sheol, it's not natural to think of the grave as the reference. It's more natural to think of hell. And then Proverbs 5 and verse 5.
Her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of hell.
Speaking of the foolish woman, and obviously, again, more appropriate to think of hell there than the grave. And then 9:18.
But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of hell.
Since we're talking here about the woman of folly, everybody dies, righteous and wicked alike, it seems more appropriate to make the meaning here hell. And then Proverbs 15:24.
The way of life is above to the wise, that he may depart from hell beneath.
All right. And again, the contrast between the righteous and the wicked suggests that the meaning of Sheol here must be hell and not the grave, since the righteous as well dies. And then Proverbs 23 and verse 14.
Thou shalt beat him with a rod and shalt deliver his soul from hell.
Again, this is not promising that if you discipline your child, he'll never die. It's promising that you'll deliver his soul from the place of punishment. Now, this is, I say, the natural meaning that all these texts suggest. But the following considerations require that this, the most natural interpretation of such text, actually be adopted. First, the statement of Proverbs 14:32 requires that something more than the grave be in view. Remember the that text, Proverbs 14:32, the wicked is thrust down by his wrongdoing, but the righteous has a refuge when he dies. Second, the fact that even the righteous go to the physical grave seems to demand much more than mere physical death, and the grave is the just punishment of the wicked in the minds of the Jewish authors of these texts. Third, the literature of intertestamental Judaism confirms that Jews did see something more in such texts than physical death in the grave. Fourth, the use of Hades in the New Testament, the Greek equivalent of Sheol, demonstrates that Sheol meant hell for the inspired authors of the New Testament. Who were Jews who got that meaning from where? From the Old Testament. This is the case because the use of Hades to mean hell in the New Testament is indisputable. And I think we begin here with Mike again. Matthew 11:23, Dave 16:18, Luke 10:15's got Luke 16:23. Larry, look at these texts where Hades indisputably refers to hell in the New Testament. Matthew 11:23.
And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You shall descend to Hades, where if the miracle that occurred in Sodom that occurred in you, you would have remained, it would have remained to this day.
And Matthew 16:18.
And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it.
Okay. And Luke 10:15.
And you, Capernaum, who are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to Hades.
And Luke 16:23.
And being in torments in Hades, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom.
Now, the fifth reason why the meaning of hell must be attributed to these Old Testament texts is simply this. The Old Testament teaches that the righteous are delivered from Sheol, in spite of the fact that in one sense the righteous die and go to Sheol, the grave. Proverbs 15:24. We've looked at that already, but let's just notice it again here. Proverbs 15:24. The path of the light of life leads upward for the wise below, that he may keep away from Sheol below. Here's the explicit assertion of the Old Testament that though in one sense all go to Sheol, the grave, the righteous don't go to this Sheol in another sense. And this is also the suggestion of Psalm 49, verses 14 and 15. As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. This is a reference to the foolish. Death shall be their shepherd. And the upright shall rule over them in the morning, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. And though it's possible that there's a reference to the resurrection in verse 15, the language "he will receive me" in other places in the Psalms seems to have a reference to what happens at death. Compare Psalm 73 and some other passages. Well, anyway, these passages require us to distinguish between a place of punishment in the afterlife from which the righteous are delivered, and the grave which symbolizes it, and from which the righteous in general are not delivered till the last day. Otherwise, the teaching that the righteous are delivered from Sheol would have no meaning. Now, you see that. By way of conclusion, the evidence for the existence of hell is not a matter of two or even or three or even ten proof texts in the Bible. The reality of hell as a place of torment for the disembodied souls of the wicked is woven into the fabric of the Bible. But not just into the fabric of the Bible, into the fabric of our very earthly existence. The very words used in the Bible to describe the condition into which we enter at death are words which remind us that death is a divine judgment. Sheol may mean the grave, but it means that because it points us to the opposite of all that is divine and blessed, and so it also means hell. Earthly existence, with its obituaries, funeral homes, and cemeteries, is a constant reminder that all mankind lives under the constant threat of divine wrath, and we never develop beyond our need for such reminders. Rather, as we grow older and the world becomes more commonplace, we need such reminders more and more. Well, we must come, though, having looked at the basic biblical words, to the basic biblical text discussing the condition of the wicked. And here, I'm going to deal simply with the four major New Testament texts. And let's hasten on, then, to deal with Luke 16. Luke 16. And you're familiar with the passage, I think, so I'm going to forbear reading it for sake of time. Luke 16 is the account, however you want to describe that account, and of course there's argument about that, of the rich man and Lazarus, the story of the rich man and Lazarus. And the teaching of Christ in these verses has been abused in at least two directions. It is made to say more than it does by hyperliteralism. Such interpreters have pressed every detail of this teaching of Christ, not realizing that in speaking of that which is inconceivable to us, Christ must use figurative language. So some have derived the doctrine of an intermediate body in heaven or in hell from this language, which contradicts other clear passages of Scripture. And on the other hand, it has also been made to say less than it does by a minimizing conservatism. Some conservative scholars, wary of the first danger, have denied that Jesus intended to teach anything here about the intermediate state. George Eldon Ladd remarks, "This parable is no commentary on contemporary social life, nor does it intend to give teaching about the afterlife. It's really not a parable about the rich man and Lazarus, but about the five brothers." Jesus used contemporary folk material to set forth the single truth that if men do not hear the word of God, a miracle such as a resurrection would not convince them. How should we respond to such a statement? Well, I think there are several appropriate responses. First, Jesus, in using this, in quotes, folk material, certainly seems to suggest that he agrees with it. Two, Ladd's interpretation would mean that the first eight verses of the story, parable, however you want to refer to it, are simply local color. This means that close to two-thirds of the parable is useless doctrinally, is only leading up to the last five verses. This, I do not think, manifest a high view of the Bible. Third, the context, as we shall see in just a moment, requires or at least strongly suggests the need for some teaching in the context on the punishment that awaits certain sins. See, those addressed in this instruction are the Pharisees, verses 14 and 15. Now, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God." And so Jesus is here responding to these mocking, rich Pharisees. Is it surprising that he tells a story about a rich man? And can we think that his reference to this rich man going to hell is not intended to have some reference to these rich Pharisees? Unthinkable, I think, in terms of the context. These Pharisees were characterized by three sinful attitudes mentioned in these verses: covetousness, scoffing at Jesus' words, and self-righteousness and self-justification for their covetous attitudes. Because the Pharisees' sins were various, the parable is two-pronged in order to expose the foolishness, particularly of covetousness and scoffing at Jesus' words. Verses 19 to 26 warn of the certain torment awaiting complacent and covetous rich men like the Pharisees. Verses 27 to 31 warn of the inability of even miraculous signs to conquer the complacency, mocking, and contempt of the Pharisees. Thus, contrary to Ladd, both parts of this description, this story, play a key role in Jesus' response to the Pharisees. Further, we must be careful to confine ourselves to interpretations and uses of these verses to reflect these two basic purposes of Jesus. So you see, the whole context suggests not that the first half of the parable is local color, but that it's addressed to one of the problems of the Pharisees, and the second half to the other problem. So clearly, the teaching of Jesus here must be applied to the intermediate state, since the five brothers of the rich man are viewed as still living an ordinary existence in this world. So, some of the language, like the tip of the finger and the water and all of that, must be understood as figurative, because the whole context is not of the eternal state, but of the intermediate state, with the five brothers still on earth living, and the Lazarus in heaven and the rich man in hell. And that's the way the words must be applied. And as we do that, there are at least two truths conveyed in the words of Jesus about the intermediate state of the wicked. First, that state is clearly one of conscious torment in Hades, verses 23 to 25. And second, it is one of inescapable torment, verse 26. That's the point of the language there. And besides all this, between us and you, there is a great chasm fixed, so that those who wish to come over from here to you will not be able, and that none may cross over from there to us. So the consciousness of the torment and the inescapability of the torment are the two truths conveyed about the condition of the wicked in the intermediate state. But now I want to turn you to the second of the four New Testament passages, and that's Acts 1:25. Acts 1 and verse 25. This is a fascinating little text, both in its brevity and what it implies in terms of importance. Warning with regard to hell. Part of the prayer of the apostles as they seek to fill the vacancy in the 12th apostolate. We read, "You, Lord, who know the hearts of all men, show which one of these two you have chosen to occupy this ministry and apostleship from which Judas turned aside to go to his own place." Go to his own place. The Bible graphically describes the circumstances of Jesus' death. We compare the text we've just read with Matthew 27:3-10 and Acts 1:16-19. There are graphic descriptions of the horrors of the circumstances of Judas' death. Yet while the circumstances of Judas' death symbolize the place of which Acts 1:25 speaks, they are not that place. There's a contrast here between two places in Acts 1:25. He left the place of ministry, the Greek topon is used there, and apostolate, and his apostleship, and he turned aside to go to his own topon. There's a contrast between the place of privilege, office, and ministry, which he left, and is going to his own place, the place peculiarly prepared for him by his sin and God's justice. He's called the son of perdition. And since he was the son of perdition, we know that the place he went to was perdition, a word that means loss, ruin, and destruction. The doctrine taught in this text is clearly this: each lost man has a place peculiarly prepared for him in hell to which he will go when he dies. It's his own. And this has several further implications. God's retribution is exact. Each has its own peculiar place. This implies differentiation in divine judgment, and such differentiation involves two distinct ideas: the idea of degradation, or degrees of torment in hell, and the idea of fitness, of or appropriateness of punishment for a man's particular sin. In other words, God's punishment will precisely and even ironically suit each man's peculiar wickedness. All this further implies that this life is determinative of the afterlife. The sin of the wicked in this life produces, according to the vengeance and justice of God, their exact place in the next. That's the implication of the language, I think, his own place. But then 1 Peter 3:19 is the third passage. 1 Peter 3:19. And I'll begin reading at verse 18, pick up the context. For Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which also he went and made proclamation to the spirits, the New American Standard adds appropriately, I think, now in prison, who once were disobedient, when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Now, many understand this verse to mean that after his death, Christ personally descended into hell and announced salvation to the spirits there. Often it is used as a proof text for the idea that Old Testament saints were delivered from Hades by Christ's death and brought at that time from Hades to heaven. It fits back in with the two-compartment theory. Now, we've already seen that this theory contradicts the clear teaching of Scripture. Furthermore, it is not supported by the teaching of this passage, since the spirits preached to here were not saints, but the rebellious and damned contemporaries of Noah. Certain cults add, therefore, that this is a proof of a second probation after death. This teaching, however, is absolutely antithetical to the whole tenor of biblical teaching. We are shut up, therefore, to the common Protestant interpretation of this verse. It is best commended by its clear explanation. This interpretation states that Christ went and preached by his Spirit, that after all is what the text actually says, in which Spirit he also went, and he preached by his Spirit not in his own day, but in Noah's day, and through Noah, to men who were in Peter's day, now, as the New American Standard adds in terms of its interpretive translation, spirits in prison. And they were spirits in prison because they had disobeyed the Spirit of Christ-empowered preaching of Noah while they were still alive. A careful inspection of verse 18 will show that it does not assert that Christ personally preached to the spirits in prison, but that in or by his Spirit he did so. And it's interesting to note that the instrumentality of Noah's proclamation of the Word of God is implied in verse 20, where we read, kept waiting in the days of Noah, and it's also referred to by Peter as well in 2 Peter 2:5, where he also refers to the preaching of Noah, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness. These parallel passages encourage the notion that Peter was thinking of Noah's preaching by the Spirit of Christ to the spirits who in Peter's day were now spirits in prison. That preaching, of course, is also mentioned in Genesis 6:3. Other mentions are made in Scripture, by the way, of preaching by Christ, which he did not perform personally and bodily, but through his Spirit. Ephesians 2:17 was that. Ephesians 2:17. Which says he might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross by it having put to death the enmity, and he came and preached peace to you who were far away and peace to those who were near. Well, how did he do that? well, certainly not in his own person, but through his emissaries and by means of the Spirit. And this is also suggested by the language of 1 Peter 1:12. The word "in prison" must therefore be understood, as the New American Standard does, by adding the words "now." They are Peter's comment on the result of these Spirit's disobedience in Noah's day. They were preached to in Noah's day when they were not simply spirits, but men living on earth. But as a result of their disobedience to that preaching, they were now spirits in prison. They were not preached to when they were spirits in prison. As a result of the preaching, they are now spirits in prison. This text, therefore, corroborates the other statements of the New Testament that the intermediate state of the wicked is a condition of divine imprisonment. This thought conveys at least three important ideas about hell. First, hell is a place from which you cannot escape. It is a divine prison. Second, hell is a place of punishment. It's a prison. Third, hell is a place where men are reserved for the day of judgment, because in the Bible, of course, prisons were not the place of ultimate punishment. They were holding pens. Till punishment. And of course, that meaning of prison must be attributed to 1 Peter 3. Well, we must come to the fourth passage quickly, and that's 2 Peter 2:9. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. Here I want to read verses 4 through 9 to pick up the context. "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness, reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, and if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them examples to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, by what he saw and heard, that righteous man while living among them felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by the lawless deeds, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment." This statement of Peter forms his conclusion from the three previous examples of divine judgment which he has cited in verses 4 through 6. It specifically alludes to verse 4 by repeating the word "to keep" used there. Verse 4 speaks of how the angels are kept, reserved for judgment, and he repeats that word in verse 9, "keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment." Thus, Peter likens the condition of all the unrighteous to that of the angels that sinned. The angels are right now kept for judgment in a place of punishment. "So also are all the unrighteous dead," says Peter. Also conclusive for a reference here to the intermediate state of the wicked is the grammar of the passage. The King James Version misses the point, and in fact the New King James corrects its mistake in translation. The verb meaning "punish" is a present passive participle which should be translated "while being punished." And so the idea is that he keeps the unrighteous while being punished for the day of judgment. While being punished, that present passive participle is translated "under punishment" by the New American Standard. Literally, this phrase reads, "but unrighteous on due day of judgment, while being punished to keep." The teaching of this passage is then that the wicked after death and while awaiting the day of judgment are kept and punished. They are guarded, literally, by the Lord. There is therefore no escape from their condition or from their judgment. While being so guarded, they are punished. The implication of the passage is that they are punished in a way and in a place similar to that in which the angels who sinned are punished, a place described as pits of darkness, 2 Peter 2:4, and eternal bonds under darkness, Jude 6. Several practical conclusions follow from this examination of the biblical teaching on the intermediate state of the wicked. First, the intermediate state of the wicked is a place of conscious torment and punishment. The torment is described as being in darkness, being chained, being burned. Second, the The intermediate state of the wicked is a place that is entered by men and prepared for men because of their sin. Described variously in these passages as covetousness, scoffing at Jesus' word, disobedience to the preaching of God's word, being unrighteous like Noah's generation and Sodom and Gomorrah, and selling Jesus for silver. So intimately related to the wickedness of men is this place that each one seems to have a unique punishment fitted to his sin. Third, the intermediate state of the wicked is a place from which there is no escape. This is demonstrated by a number of different considerations in these texts. There's a great gulf fixed so that none go from Hades. It is described as a prison in which the Lord is the keeper. There is therefore consequently no escape from this place. It is a man's own place in the afterlife as his unique abode prepared for him. There is no escape from it. And this answers the question as to whether there is a second chance for men after death to be saved. The wicked are kept in this prison for the specific purpose of arraigning them in the day of judgment, 2 Peter 2:9. Besides the considerations flowing out of the text already mentioned, what other biblical considerations demand this conclusion? Well, 1 Peter 3:20 implies that God's patience ended with the death of these men. When the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. This thought is corroborated by the words of Jesus in John 8:21 and 24. He speaks of their dying in their sin. There's a note of finality contained in those words of Jesus. To die in sin is clearly for Jesus a dreadful thing, but we may ask, why so dreadful if there's a second chance after death? Note also that the final judgment proceeds on the basis of the earthly life of men. There is always a reference to the earthly life of men as the exclusive basis of judgment in the different passages. Revelation 14:13 speaks of their deeds following them, as 1 Timothy 5 does. Matthew 10:32-33, to point out to men once to die, and after this the judgment. But of course the key passage is 2 Corinthians 5:10, they shall be judged for the deeds done in the body. Every place, and in all the references to judgment in the Bible, it is only the deeds done while on earth. It is only the deeds done while in the body. It's whether you looked after Christ's people on earth or whether you didn't. Matthew 25. It's the deeds done in the body that are the exclusive basis of eternal judgment. And there is never, in addition to this, any reference to any possible change due to behavior in the afterlife in terms of one eternal state. Well, dark subject, but I hope this helps you to know how to preach it to your people and gives you some understanding of it. You have questions? Yes, Todd.
I have two questions. Are you saying that in 1 Peter 3:19, God's use of now, is that use of now warranted by the Greek, or are you suggesting that it's also interpreted?
Yeah, there is no word now in the Greek. I'm saying that I think it's a helpful interpretive guide. Because I think Peter's point is exactly what the New American Standard is saying by inserting the now, but I have to admit there's literally no word in the Greek equivalent to now. Okay.
Second one.
Mm-hmm. He's in the lower compartment of the
Well, how about Samuel?
You mean you're talking about the...
How do you understand that passage? I'm saying in light of the fact that he was in
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Oh, where is that passage? I probably don't need to turn there, because what I'm going to end up saying is that I don't know that I want to offer any definitive or dogmatic interpretation of the passage. I guess I'm allowed to say, even though you've asked me to come here to teach this course, that about that I'm not sure. Okay. I do know that there are vast variations among the interpreters about how they do take the passage, and I suppose we have suggested some things that would go in the direction of saying that what you have here is not the word I want. The reality of the invisible state and of the invisible world, but what appeared to that witch. I'm not sure I could go much farther than that. I guess I would think it's a vision, but I know then that I'm going to have other objections raised about that. In light of what I've said, Samuel was certainly in heaven and not coming up from below. So that may be suggestive. I'm not sure he wants to be dogmatic or express an opinion about it. Yes, Andrew.
In the last lecture, we said if you know what heaven is, you don't know where it is.
Yeah.
But there's spatial. Can we say that we know what hell is and it is spatial, and we do know that it is in the confines of the planet Earth, and therefore, I don't mean to be speculative, but somebody can dig deep enough.
I don't believe that. I think it is spiritually below, figuratively below, and not literally below. And therefore, I think it is a place, but I don't know where it is.
And okay. How would that relate then to the communication that you have in the parable between the two sides?
Mm-hmm. That's an awfully good question. And I think that may be one of the figurative aspects of the parable that we're not to press in a literal fashion. Mm-hmm. Todd?
So you believe that the things in heaven will see the torment of the raging hell?
I think that's suggested in some sense by the Bible. Isaiah 66 seems to suggest it. At least suggested there's awareness of it. But I'm not prepared to be too dogmatic about that. Other questions, Bob?
In number 16, where the sons of Korah are punished by God, it says that they're swallowed alive.
Mm-hmm.
They went alive down into the pit.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a parallel to the Old Testament saints who went alive bodily into heaven? These people went bodily into hell?
I don't understand. That's not what my first reaction to the text would be. It would be that there was a kind of earthquake that God caused, and they weren't dead when the earth swallowed them up like most people were. They were alive. So no, I don't think that would be a parallel personally. I wouldn't interpret it that way. I would simply say that it means that they went down into the bowels of the earth and they were alive when that happened, in contrast to the fact that most people are dead when they're buried. It's a horrible thing to think about, and of course that's the point of the text.
Well, I thought there was a parallel there. What a glorious thing it was for Enoch and Elijah to go bodily into heaven, but this may have been something of a parallel going the other way of the ultimate destiny of the wicked.
And certainly they're going down alive. It's symbolic of that. And there may be a suggestion of the blessedness of the one by the horror of the other, but I wouldn't want to conclude that they actually went bodily into hell at that point. I doubt that.
What about the snake? This fit in the last lecture better, but I didn't think of it then. What about the saints who were resurrected, for example, Lazarus, and the saints who were resurrected at the resurrection of Christ?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their blessed hope was kicked into reverse, and they came back from a sinless experience to a sinful experience again.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Lazarus' resurrection was not an eschatological resurrection. I don't think there's any reason to think that he didn't die again. And whether he had any conscious experience of heaven while he was dead, or the Lord perhaps suppressed his consciousness for the very reason that he was going to be raised from the dead, is something we can speculate about. As to the saints who were raised, where is that passage? Is that Matthew 27? End of Matthew 27. The tombs were open, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. I'm frankly not sure whether, you know, if it was the eschatological resurrection, then eventually they went to heaven. If it was some sort of sign and a temporary vivification of these people, then eventually somehow God put them back in their tombs, I suppose. I'm really not prepared to speculate about that, and I'm not sure of any, maybe some of you are, but I'm not sure of any other data that would allow us to be too dogmatic about this. It's possible, there are different kinds of resurrections. There are resurrections back into the life of this age, and there are age to come resurrections. And and your interpretation of this passage is going to depend on which kind of resurrection you think this is.
This is one of the obscure passages to be interpreted by the plain and not the other.
That's right. And all I have here is the limits of what I know from the rest of the Bible, not a lot of certainty about this one. Other questions? Yes, Mike.
One of the comments was that the angels are right now kept for judgment in place of punishment. I wonder how that relates to the activity of Satan if he gets there to come in.
Well, that's a good question. And I'm not sure I know exactly how to comment about that. One of the interesting things about the text is that it uses a unique word. The language cast them into hell, if my memory serves me, is the word tartarize them.
Right. What was that?
2 Peter 2, verse 4. 2 Peter 2 and verse 4. The verb cast them into hell is tartarosis, mm-hmm. which is a word used in Greek mythology to speak of, I forget what exact mythological beings it refers to, but titans, I think, from some earlier stage of church history, were supposed to have been bound by the gods in Tartarus. And that's the word Peter uses here, not because he's buying into all the mythology for certain, but perhaps he regarded it as an appropriate word to use when you're speaking of mighty beings like angels. At any rate, you really can go one of two directions, I suppose, Mike. You can say that he's not referring to all fallen angels, only certain specific ones who are, or you could say, and this is perhaps where you might want to go with it, or what you're suggesting, that even though they're bound in hell in some sense, they can still exercise some sort of influence, and that we really don't know what the binding of a spiritual being actually means, and therefore we don't know what the binding of a being like Satan means in terms of how his influence may still be extended in some way. And I think that's a legitimate point to make, but I'm not sure how hard we compress this text. It's possible that only a certain limited group of angels is in view. Okay. Okay. Huh?